Facing challenges and overcoming setbacks is part of doing business. Whether you have the expertise to survive them or not could mean the difference between success or failure. Welcome to We Are Women, featuring revealing conversations that provide invaluable insights into the success secrets of female masterminds. A must listen for every entrepreneurial woman. Now here's your host, Janine Vosper.
Hi, it's Janine Vosper, and welcome to this episode of the We Are Women podcast. I have the gorgeous Jessica McElveen with me today. So growing up in a childhood environment filled with anxiety, depression, addiction, I'll pronounce that word correctly, Jessica, just push the teeth back. Jessica knows too well that disharmony is created for everyone in the family when these are present in the home. Jessica has been working with families around the world since 2012 as a leading parent coach, speaker, and researcher to bring harmony and connection back into their homes. Jessica is a degree qualified social worker, a neuro-linguistic programming master practitioner, a timeline therapist, hypnotist, child yoga therapist. Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. And was Australia's first epigenetic behavioral coach. Beginning her professional career as a social worker, Jessica felt stilted by the systematic restrictions on how she could support families through the social work and foster care systems. I'm going to leave it there because there's other things in here that I want to be able to bring out and talk about, Jessica. Yeah. That sort of covered a fair bit in that introduction. And there's a lot of things that you've done there, but the point of getting out of the social worker environment, so tell me, you know, the catalyst behind that. What's wrong with it, but what was wrong with it for you?
Yeah, that's a better way of putting the question, isn't it? What was it? Yeah, what wasn't okay for me? So I guess, Janine, you always go into these roles with really good intentions. You go in really wanting to make a difference, and that was absolutely me, of course. And you don't really know what the system is like until you get inside the system. You don't really understand what the expectations are. You don't know what the rules are, the restrictions, the limitations. You don't really understand any of it until you're in there. And I guess what I found in the years that I was working within that system was I felt it was really narrow-minded. It was a bit short-sighted as well. And I felt like it was a little bit blame-based as well. That's what I felt. Yeah. So, you know, I'll give you an example. One of my roles when I was working within the foster care world and system, you know, I was responsible for writing up reports about children. I was responsible for these reports then going to potential foster carers. I was responsible for choosing carers to take these children. You know, what are their profiles? Does it match? And what I can't handle is the slippery slope we go on when we start to use certain language to describe a child. And what I found, and I guess the catalyst for me, was working with this one family, and there was a lot of language used to describe this little boy. Now, this little boy was 6 years of age, and it's not uncommon in that world, or the medical world, to be honest, but it's not uncommon in that world for words like violent, manipulative, aggressive, these words to be used for a child age 3 or 4.
Oh, you know,
it's not uncommon. And so if I was to give you a sheet of paper and you were to read this page on this 6-year-old child, and he's described as aggressive, violent, and manipulative, then it's not really going to set him up for a world of success in the world that he is in. He's already in foster care, okay? He's already living outside of his biological home. And so one of the things that I was constantly fighting up against was the lack of, I guess, desire for foster carers, for me as the social worker and everybody else, actually digging deeper behind the behavior and having the foster carers really dig deep into their own set of belief systems around behaviors. So I found that my role was mainly to keep foster carers happy. And when you do that, you're on a sinking ship. You're on a sinking ship because these behaviors that we're seeing from children that are traumatized, okay, there's intergenerational trauma here. But if we are not having carers really question their own belief systems, question their nervous system and how their nervous system is reacting, the language they're using, what they believe is right and wrong, if I'm not getting a foster carer to really reflect on their own self and well-being and thoughts, belief systems, conditioning, then we're doing the children a disservice, if you ask me. And that's what I consistently saw. So I felt like if a child didn't change after 6 months of seeing a psychologist, it was the child's fault. It couldn't be the psychologist. No. It couldn't be them. It couldn't be the fact that they didn't connect with the child or, you know, and I had a problem with that. I had a problem that we were only giving them talk-based therapies when if you know anything about a child's brain, that's not going to transform them. It's not going to change them. They don't have access to this part of the brain. So I guess along the way, you know, in a big lengthy summary, that's why I just didn't agree with the approach. And I really felt that was a better way and a different way of choosing to understand these children and choosing to support them.
Yeah. As a, you know, a grandmother of five and, you know, from the ages from 4 to 18, but most of them, you know, 6, 5, 7 and 7 today, or 4, 5, 7 and 9, I can't imagine how you could read that into a child and then give them that badge. That's their badge they wear for the rest of their life, because it then becomes a switch, doesn't it, that they then own it. If everyone tells them that, well, then so it be, and then the rest of their life is reflecting. And that even, you know, not just for children, then they become adults and, you know, thinking about listeners on here, women who then own this badge is going, well, I'm useless, I'm worthless, I haven't got anything to offer, why would I go out in my own business? Nobody's going to value anything that I am. And it creates that continuous cycle, doesn't it, from the childhood badging to you know who we become as adults. Now you've done the NLP and the timeline therapy. So this, did you do this after you, or while you were, you know, working as a social worker, or when I need more tools? Is this through that?
So it was a bit, I did know I wanted more tools and I did know I wanted to do it differently. And this was one of the paths, but it was after I'd already chosen to quit social work. And so a pattern with me, Janine, is if something doesn't feel right, or I feel like I'm stuck, I'll quit and I'll travel, or I'll decide to live overseas. So that's what I did. I quit social work and decided that I'd live in Italy for a few years. So
not a bad decision.
It's not a bad decision. It never happened though, because I, you know, I decided that I needed to start a business. So at that time I was experiencing my own panic and anxiety attacks, and I chose meditation and yoga to really deal with that instead of the medication route that the doctor just wanted to do with me, which doesn't align with me or what I believe in. So, I left that system, went to yoga and meditation, and that really was my, God, did it save me? It really was my savior. And I guess, you know, a question popped into my mind when I was on the couch in the UK with a friend of mine, and she said, well, you know, why don't you just do what you think works for you and what you love with the children that you want to help? And I thought to myself, oh my God, that's it. I'd rather work with the body with these children, because that's where we store everything. And that's what the missing piece is. So I went and trained as the yoga therapist first, and that's the first business that I started. And then as I continued on down the path, I needed more tools, and then I needed to learn more about this brain of ours and this body. And so I continued training down the path of NLP and epigenetics and a lot of neuroscience research and all of that. So it happened afterwards.
Right. And epigenetics, can you just explain that for people listening?
Sure. So we've got genes, right? We've got our genetic makeup. Now, 5% of these are hereditary. Okay. We've got 5% that are hereditary and make up who we are. It's really our epigenetics that has us be the people that we are in this world. So epigenetics is really lifestyle genetics of our bodies that the parts of our bodies, the parts of our genes and our makeup that interact with our external environment. So they're interacting with the type of lifestyle that you lead, the foods that you eat, the people that you're around, because that is your mood and which hormones get stimulated in those relationships and those scenarios. So our epigenetics is what is expressed in our life. So it comes down to behaviors then. And so what I supported families to do with their children is understanding how their epigenetics is working within the world. So depending on what hormones are dominant in the body also dictates what behaviors we see a lot of the time and where a child feels safe and comfortable, why the parent can find their children really confusing. Maybe the child is desiring a different hormone and the behavior attached to that hormone versus the parent, and which hormone is dominant for them and they're seeking, and that's a different behavior attached to that. So there's just a whole world of things that, you know, if we only look at the behavior and judge it as violent, we're missing a whole heap of information and understanding of why a child is the way that they are.
Is there an easy way to identify that, or, you know, is that a to test hormones? Is that a blood test even to do that?
So there are different types of epigenetic testing you can do. So I work with naturopaths that do epigenetic testing for clients. There's also a company out there that you can do epigenetic testing, behavioral epigenetic testing. That company is called PH360. So you can do it through them. It's quite easy. So they're the methods that make it pretty easy to understand from a behavioral standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just makes so much sense that what's coming into us, to us from around the world. You know, I was listening to something the other day and they were talking about how many satellites are in the sky. But we're talking, you know, 5G. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because it's a really good conversation as well. But there, if you're thinking, I'll go outside and walk on the ground and ground myself. Well, there's 7,000 satellites are floating above us at the moment. But how much is that affecting even what we can do with our connection to the earth? And the aim is to have 400,000 satellites in the
sky. Wow.
It'd look impressive if you're out in the bush and watching them all go past. I mean, that's good. But can you imagine how much an effect that's going to have on the on us? It's, you know, like standing in front of them in a microwave, not in front of one, but actually standing in a microwave on a daily basis. Yeah, and that's going to have some effect, hasn't it?
This is just one little thing that nobody in the medical sphere will consider. You know, nobody in these systems will consider the impact of anything outside of just the behavior that they're seeing and using consequences and punishment to get rid of it somehow, or talking it through with a child at five who really doesn't know why she's behaving the way that she is. So it's not holistic in nature, and it's very narrow-minded. And, you know, if anyone has listened to me before, I don't make it a secret that I'm not for labels and the diagnoses that we receive or children receive. Short term, often they are helpful because we can understand something we haven't understood before, but long term, I haven't seen many families where it's benefited long term, because we tend to then put people in that rabbit hole. And again, we're not considering other things that are going on in this child's mind and body. So whenever we're, you know, labeling or badging, as you said, I love that word, actually, we're limiting our view of that child. And I was only speaking to a mum an hour ago. Now, she wanted to find out how to work with me. And I've spoken to hundreds and hundreds of mums, thousands of parents. And this was the first time I had heard, I think there was about 10 diagnoses for this one child.
Wow. 10. What a clever little child.
And for me, I was listening to the language and the jargon and the medical terms that this mum was sharing. Now, I have no question that this mum is coming from a place of just love and wanting her child to be okay and trying to figure her child out. Totally understand that. Where I have a problem is that we have this medical world who sees all of these problems. That's it. And when there's another problem, we just have another label to slap onto it. That's it.
Yeah.
And we don't look deep enough, and we don't look at ourselves then, and we don't look at the environment, and we don't look at our biology, and we don't look at all of these other factors that are just a bit more holistic in nature that play more of a part. So I think there's rabbit holes we can go down when we start putting all these badges on children and adults that are really unhealthy long term.
And that comes down to it as well, you know, because that's the thing with being a parent of a child that's got behavioural issues, is then to, oh, hang on, I'm busy, I've got to go to work, I've got to go, there's a whole lot of other things happening in our lives that it's just easier if I've got a label and I can pop the child over here doing this, and because there's so many expectations on people to succeed, to achieve. Yeah. You have to only have to look at social media that, you know, everyone's, I got this great meme that I posted up on my Facebook, and it was two cats really going at it, and it said, this is what it's like at home. And then there was a picture of two cats with their arms spread as if they're on the front of the Titanic going, this is what it looks like in public. You know, it's really very cute. But that's what it's like. There's all this stress and intensity coming at people all the time, with having to have a, how are they perceived by everybody else? And then when it comes to children behaving badly or difficultly or not conforming to what is expected behavior, it just adds another level of stress, and then it adds that level of guilt and responsibility on the parents, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And you know, conformity is really encouraged, and conformity is really expected at so many different spheres in our society. Mm-hmm. So to go against the grain takes a whole world of courage, a whole world of courage. And there hasn't been one mum to date that I've worked with that when I've dug and I've dug and I've dug, we have this monstrous fear of what will people think of me. And, you know, out in public, we have children melting down, or we have tantrums, or we have, you know, a child yelling, whatever it is. Okay. And mum is so concerned about what people are thinking that she's lost her child, because her child knows that she is more focused on other people. Mm. They don't have her attention. And most of the time, that's creating more issues than just focusing on the child and what they're doing and what they need anyway. This real addiction and this real fear of what people think, I don't think parents realize how much that's doing to their children in those tough moments in escalating the behaviors. Children, they can read parents better than parents can read themselves. You know, they come out of the womb and they are reading body language, nonverbals, tones of voice, eye patterns, everything, you name it. That is their primary communication method. They have analyzed you from tip to toe 5 million trillion times. So we can't get anything past them. We can't. They are our little lie detector, discomfort detector, anxious detector, everything. They've got it covered. So they're good at reflecting back to us how we're doing in the moment. And if we're not doing so well, they're going to continue escalating. So that's usually a lot of the work that I need to do with mums, is understanding the depths of why we care so much about what these people think. What have we made it mean? What in our conditioning or our own childhood has this fear been created? Why do you not want to be perceived as that person, that mum, that woman? So we usually... yeah, 9 times out of 10 have to go backwards for the mums too.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it is usually, you know, something that has come from our own childhood or our upbringing as to why this is so important. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I think when you become a little bit more aware that you can make choices in your behaviour, mm-hmm. and as you mature, that mm-hmm. it's not as important anymore, what other people think. But when you are raising children, it seems, you know, there's so much judgment on you. And it's not just from other parents, it's the school system, it's the government, it's everywhere else that we, if they don't conform as well as the others. So, you know, I've two sons who are now in their late mid-30s. My second son had just attention issues and really smart. You know, at 3-year-old, he was asked to cut a circle at kindy on the first day. And they gave him a pair of scissors to cut a circle just to check fine motor skills. So he folded the piece of paper in four and cut an arc and then handed back the circle at 3. No, but attention. Wow. And now, still at 36, he's still attention. It's sort of shiny objects everywhere and what's happening around. But he's always about 3 steps ahead of everybody else in any moment as well. And it's, yes, it's that different people. But he was in a private school and we took him out and put him in a state school system because he could take every book he needed to the classroom. He didn't have to get the right books out of the locker for the right period of time. He'd just have everything in his bag and be outside the room. He didn't have to worry about really fancy uniforms. He could just wear shorts and T-shirts as his uniform. So those things, you know, just made his life a lot easier by doing that instead of staying in the private school. It suited his brother, but it definitely didn't suit him at all. And it's just little things like that, isn't it? Not trying to push a square peg into a round hole. It just didn't fit for him.
Yeah. And he's lucky that he's got a mum that realizes different children need different things and different parenting styles. And that's often what sometimes I find that mums really struggle with is that, well, I'm exhausted from altering my parenting style from child to child and trying to meet the different needs that each child has. And I can only imagine how absolutely exhausting that is. So my goal is to simplify it as much as possible. So if I can dig through the dirt and make things so easy for this mum and this family to understand what's really going on, and that she's not stuffing up her child and ruining his future and all of these things that mums are often thinking they're doing, then it's all worth it. But it can be really simple. When our emotions are involved, as you are as a mum, we can often complicate things. So that's what I'm here for, is to really make it simple.
And that's a good point about the emotions, because you know, it's really hard. From the time your child is born, you're there as the defender of that child. And they're part of you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for both parents, but the mother's the one that carries the child. And you just have that, you've protected them from the word go. And I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, babies crying and just, you know, letting them with a sleep, that the children, the babies that don't sleep and things. And it's really hard. It's so hard to listen to your child cry. It's one of the hardest things. Sometimes it's necessary. We've got to build resilience somewhere along the way, and things going wrong and having to deal with them and come through them is how we do that. But it is one of the hardest things to do, to watch your child cry.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah, it's certainly true. Now, you said that just reading part of your bio, that you got into this to save children and parents because you couldn't save your own.
So which I realized when I entered social work. So I knew early on, you know, why I got into it. And I guess it's the old cliche, Janine, you go in to help the people that you couldn't help when you were young. And for me, you know, it was my parents. So my dad was an alcoholic and suicidal for many, many, many years of my life, a lot of my childhood. You know, there was gambling, and there was a lot of addictions, unfortunately, because that was the only way he could manage his own demons. And so there was a lot going on for dad, We went bankrupt because of the gambling. So there was a lot of things going on for us. And then I had to deal with what it was like to try and have my dad stay alive every day that he told me goodbye. And then my mum was in survival mode every single day. So she was stressed. She was depressed. She was anxious. She was overloaded, trying to put food on the table and house us, of course, and keep my dad alive as well. She still cared about him. They did separate because of all of this going on. But, you know, my danger switch was active all of the time. I was in fear mode. I felt like my world was unpredictable. I didn't know ever what I was coming home to from school. I was in fear, terror mode all of the time. And I felt like within that, as the eldest child, I really needed to be the caretaker of the family too. So I really took that role on. I needed to be the caretaker for my parents, my brother and my sister. I needed to predict what was going to happen. I needed to fix everything, save everyone. I needed to figure out how I could be the therapist for my parents and what's the magic sentence I need to say. Or, you know, I was forever in problem solving mode, trying to help them, because at the end of the day, I just wanted to feel really happy and safe in my days. And I knew that what that took was to have my parents happy and have them be okay. I knew that at some level, but I was terrified all of the time, really terrified.
And that is so unfair to put that on a child.
And I took that on, and, you know, mm-hmm. I think at some point, you know, we choose it as a child. And, you know, my parents, they're wonderful. I have a, you know, a really great relationship with them. Mm-hmm. Dad's gone through a lot, and he's now disabled due to his alcoholism. So there's been a massive journey there for us all. But yeah, it was really challenging. And so that's what I mean when I say I went into it to really try and have children have a strong, safe home, because that's what I really wanted. And I wanted my parents to be happy. I just wanted them to be okay, so then I could be okay.
Yeah. And did you ever come across many other people who have had that trauma that have stepped into those protector type of roles, like the social worker? I know a client who became a policewoman because that was what she did, was protect her siblings also.
Yeah, it happens so often. You know, there's a saying that goes, you often preach what you need to hear yourself. So in then speaking to children, I was a therapist for children for many years. So I got to be the person for them that I wish somebody was for me, right? And then now I work with parents. And now I'm the person sharing with them what I guess somebody shared with my parents once in a while.
Yeah.
And so you do get into the fields that have some sort of strong connection to you and what was great and maybe not so great when you were young. I've seen that a lot too. A lot of psychologists get into it too, as you know, wanting to repair or heal something within themselves.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept, isn't it? So once you've identified, you know, it wouldn't be one thing with the epigenetics, and it could be the food or the environment, or, you know, what I imagine it's quite a lot of different things that are impacting on the behaviour. Then do you then recommend people go to certain other specialists, like a naturopath or people like that? Mm-hmm. How do you work within that framework?
Yeah, so they'll work with me one-on-one mostly. So I'll do all of the behavioural side of things and the digging and the parent side of things. Mm-hmm. And then so I've got a team, so it's the Happy Home Network is what it's called, and I've got a team that consists of naturopaths, nutritionists. I've got EFT practitioners, and I've got kinesiologists and Reiki masters, and yes, NLP practitioners. And so I like to bring them into working with my families in a really specialized way. So each family will receive a different type of support package depending on what's going on with each family member.
No, that's great. Yeah, because it doesn't just leave them hanging. There's other things there that they can do. I just made me think, you know, with my youngest son, at the start of every school year, I do a kinesiology appointment just to clear off stuff for the year so he could try and stay as focused as he possibly can.
Yeah.
That was well.
And that would have been considered weird back then.
Yeah, right? I was just about to say that it was really, it was very unusual. And that particular kinesiologist, not who I go to now, but he is still around.
So that would have been, you know, brave for you to talk about that stuff out loud. And, you know, a lot of people would have had judgments on that as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, I can't remember. I just remember that looking for something that was non-medication that would work and help him have clarity. And if it worked once, then, you know, why not do it again the next time? And it'll help again.
Wow.
Yeah, maybe it'll help him now at 36. No, we won't get to that.
It could help us all, let's face it.
Oh, absolutely. And that all of this, you know, when there's a lot of disharmony in the home, then we're, you know, coming back to the mothers who are then, we talked about that judgment on themselves, that feeling guilt. What you would probably see is they're just losing themselves as well, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Every time, Janine, every time. I don't think there's been one woman yet one mum who hasn't said, you know, I have lost myself and I can't remember the last time I did anything for myself or meeting my own needs, and I feel angry at everybody else because nobody else is meeting my needs either. So then we get angry at others for not doing it too. But, you know, when we turn the mirror around, we're not doing it for ourselves or they're not doing it for them. So it's by far a fundamental strategy to make change in a home. And that's why within every program I do, without a shadow of a doubt, it's the self-care aspect. And I don't like using the word self-care because I think it just gets this airy-fairy connotation to it. But it's mums meeting their own needs and doing something that enriches their soul and their own mind and their bodies. If that is not happening and that is not a priority, then we've got problems. And we may not see it in the short term, but it is going to build up and we are going to see some problems.
I remember I presented to a group of business leaders. It was a women's forum and there were a few hundred leaders in the room, and I was doing a breakout group and I was talking about work-life balance. But I was listening at lunchtime to different groups of people, and they were talking about themselves and the stresses that they had and trying to balance everything in their lives. So it was obviously a good topic when I came to after lunch to be able to speak to the group. There was about 40 women. And my first question I asked is, what do you do for yourself? There was one woman that said that she does competitive biking. And that was her thing. And not one other, they were talking about hairdressers, and I thought, well, that's just maintenance. It's great that you do it and take the time to do it, but it really is maintenance. It's not going to enrich your soul. It's not going to, you know, lift you up when you're having a bad, well, maybe it does. Massages certainly do that, don't they? But they couldn't answer. They could not answer. And these were women in top executive roles, particularly across big business and government, that could not answer that question. And I'm sure they're the ones that would be out there that would, you know, put their children first for probably everything. And I see this, again, I've gone on tangent here, is we can't afford an overseas holiday, but the 12-year-old is going to a camp in France, and of course they'll fund that.
Okay. And
rather than saying no.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
No, it's that not putting yourself first. And then if you don't do that, every decision you make after that is based on lack.
Yeah.
It's based on a lack of energy, a lack of enthusiasm, a lack of happiness, a lack of money, a lack of all different resources. So you're making all those decisions from that space rather than, and it's not selfish. It's warranted. Fill your cup first, ladies. Absolutely. And then when
Yeah.
you do that, you've got so much more to give.
Yeah.
And when
Yeah.
there are tough times, you can be the rock for other people and you won't sink.
And when you say that, when you say they're coming from lack, you know, one of the things with human behavior is something will always fill in that gap. So when we're not coming from love and we're not coming from patience and we're not coming from kindness and we're not coming from that full cup, what gets in there instead? So what fills it instead? And usually it's always resentment. So resentment is the number one. You will start resenting your partner or your husband, your wife. You will. And you will start resenting your children at some point. I haven't, you know, that creeps on in. And there's guilt around that too. But like any other relationship, your relationship to your child is another relationship. It is the most important relationship. I can totally understand and appreciate that as a mum, but it still is another relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's where resentment can still creep on in. And then that becomes very uncomfortable. And then more guilt creeps on in than that's even present. How can you even be resentful as a mum to your child? That's disgusting. It's disgraceful. You are a bad mother, horrible person.
Mm-hmm.
And then we try and make up for that resentment in other ways, which is what I've seen many, many mums do. So the guilt and the resentment has them try and give more, but really we're just digging a deeper hole. So, and what I usually like to say to mums with this whole field of guilt is we tend to, what I've seen as patterns with mums is they'll wait until maybe the guilt isn't there. So they'll have in their mind, well, let me just get through this phase and then I can start focusing on myself. Or when I see that my child is this way, then I can focus on myself because the guilt won't be there then. Because if I take time now, that's horrible. And mm-hmm. and what I have to say is that that guilt feeling, that guilt, it's never going away. Why let's be comfortable with guilt as a feeling in general, because it doesn't mean that it's right. It doesn't mean that we need to listen to it. It's just a feeling. And like every other feeling, sometimes it's just a little skewed. It's not giving us the right information. So usually what I'm doing is having mums be comfortable with guilt and making a choice anyway. And that's the power of choice, is that we feel the feelings, we have the guilt, we know the thoughts are there, but mm-hmm. we still choose something different because that leads to a greater good. It leads to greater long-term outcomes for everyone.
That makes a lot of sense to do that, because as you said, the feelings will still be there or the thoughts will still be there. And that's an interesting thing with beliefs, isn't it? A belief is an idea. It's not a fact. It's just something that is accumulated over time. And if you start to believe it, then it changes your behavior and all the way down the track. But looking at a belief and going, no, is that reasonable? Is it serving me? Is it not? And why and where do I go from there? Again, a whole other conversation about beliefs. What's one of the first steps that parents could do to change the behaviors in the home? Is there something simple that you could suggest?
Yeah. So I think the first step is actually understanding one thing, and it's changing our view on behaviors. So the thing that I'm always saying to parents is that there's never any negative behaviors, only protective behaviors. Okay, so we're in a world at the moment that wants to judge every single behavior. And when we judge a behavior, we're always judging it for the negative. So if we're coming at a behavior with this negative lens, this judgmental lens, then I'm sorry, parents, but you're always going to lose, and so is your child. That's just, and these are my human behavior phenomenas, right? We can't avoid these human behavior phenomenas, even if we are dealing with children. So if you come at any behavior with your husband, wife, child, with a judgment lens, with that negative lens, that there's something wrong here, mm-hmm. and it's going to continue, and your reaction to that behavior will perpetuate it. It will perpetuate it. So we might like to think that we're coming at it with this reaction that will change the behavior. But if it's built with fear and control in it, then I'm really sorry. But there's something within our human behavior systems and how we react with each other, with your child, with you, that has it perpetuate. It's not going away. So what there is to get is we remove that judgment lens and we actually put on the curious lens. So the curiosity lens really is so simple, but it tends to change a lot of the views that parents have in the moment or after the moment when we see behaviors. So, you know, let's say that we see our kids fighting again. You know, fighting, I know, is the bane of many, many parents. Right. And we judge it and we get in the judgment lane and we're in the lane for 10 years or 5 years and we're in it. And we have to break that if we're really to break our reactions and we're really to, you know, focus on the bigger picture. So the curious lens tends to save us, especially when we want the connection back with our children quicker. Okay. And especially, you know, mums out there, if your parents are coming into the teen years, that curious lens better be on. Because if you've got that judgment lens, you start to get disconnected anyway, just how the natural progression of the teen brain goes. But if you don't have that curious lens on, it's disconnect tenfold. So I guess the first step really is scrap the judgment lens, because that will not have you both win, but the curious lens will. There's always a reason behind the behavior, and usually it's to protect the child of something. They're doing it to protect themselves of something. And please, please, please never expect logic within that. It may not make any sense to you, and that's actually okay. So do not expect logic.
Yeah, that's a very good point too. I mean, there's a lot of things happening, and you know, people who have suffering anxiety and stress and depression and that will look at themselves and go, you know, I shouldn't be feeling like this. Everything in my life is perfect. I'll make that judgment call on themselves as well. Mm-hmm. We're very good at doing that, aren't we? Just judging everything, and it's bad enough when it comes from outside, but when we're doing it for ourselves, that's and it's really, it's an interesting thing. It was a behavior that I learned from my parents and recognized that I did it, and now I pull myself up on it. I notice that if I'm doing it, I go, what's it to you, you know? It's not my problem, and it does, but it's recognizing when you're doing it and pulling yourself on it and going, oh, that's really, and sometimes, and my saying is, well, that's really interesting. And so then it actually is that curious, is what you're saying, is stepping and going, oh, what? Yeah, that we had all the grandkids here the other day, and two of them siblings, and they, 6 and 9, 7 today. And not the date this came out, but the date we're recording. And they're amazing kids. They're just fabulous and love having them around. And their mother came then and got in the pool. Two different children.
Oh, yeah.
Totally different children. It was,
yes.
It was, yeah, it was like, I'm getting out of here. This is not my game to play.
Yeah.
It's very, very, very different.
Yeah, happens all the time.
Yeah. And it was just there's a trigger here, and then they fought with each other, the kids, and it was definitely that trigger. Interesting.
They can let loose then, and often and I hear this a lot from mums who you know, hear from teachers, oh, they're the most beautiful children at school, and then they come home and then, you know, they're terrors, right? And parents are often asking, well, why me, what have I done so wrong? And it's actually the opposite. It's, you know, what have you done so right, so that they feel so safe they can just let everything explode at home. Because often at school, when it's an environment of unpredictability, you don't know how a teacher's going to react. You've got all of these other things to concern your little brains with. They'll hold it all in. The volcano is building up through the day, and they'll hold it all in. And some children are okay with managing that. But there are some children who haven't built up the skills just yet, and they need to let it all out at home.
That's a good point. I had never, ever considered that. It was the same, you know, if they went to someone else's house to play, they'd go, oh, they're just wonderful children. They're so good. They're so well-mannered and all of that. But, yeah, I have to tell you, Miss 4-year-old wears a vest in the pool, a swimming vest. Yeah. And I was just having a conversation with her. I said, you're so brave. You're so courageous. I'm really impressed with how you do things because you're so brave. And the next minute she took the vest off and just went swimming without it, which we'd been trying to get her to do for about 2 hours. It was just a couple of words. And I did label it. I suggested that this could be a behavior with saying that she already was that. She already was courageous. It was quite funny. It was, okay, vest off. I'm fine.
Yeah. So imagine if we had that mentality with anything else, right? Yeah. It's we're really giving the children the space to enter into an identity, yeah. Right? So what identity are you providing your children? It's a good question. What yeah. identity am I creating for them?
Mm. No, that is so important, is because that, as I've talked about right at the beginning, that's something you'll then own as your badge to use forever, you know, because unless you choose to change the story and change the narrative and recognize that you can, by the way, you just have to look at how you do that. When we finish up, we usually have have three takeaway points, Jessica. So if you want to, something that you want people to definitely remember from, you know, the conversation.
Yeah, sure. So I had to think about this, and I just thought on the general, what are the biggest things that my clients get out of working with me? So one of the biggest things I would say is that parenting strategies really mean nothing unless we understand ourselves first. Mm. So I can give a parent all the strategies in the world, and I do. But if I did that without actually digging deep and understanding that parent and having them understand themselves first, they would be wasting their time, and so would I. So mm-hmm. unless we understand why our children trigger us so much, why there is issues, why I respond this way, why I'm repeating this pattern all the time, it actually won't matter how your children change. It won't matter, because in the 18 years that they might be living in your home, they will change 500,000 times. And so if you're not understanding yourself first, then you've got 18 years at least, right, of being thrown from pillar to post, trying to change them all of the time. It's an absolute waste of your time and energy. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So really understand yourself first, and then the parenting strategies will help you and support you. So that's the number one. Number two is, and I get this a lot, parents really, they don't necessarily want to go down the medication route or path, and they don't know that it's possible that you can help your children or support them and have them still be a confident, resilient little and big person without the use of medication, that school is going to be so hard for them that they'll never make it, or because they didn't focus in school, then they're not going to be anything when they leave school, and that medication is the only way. And it's just not. It's not the only way. So when you think about what medication does, medication works with the parts of our brain that regulates our hormones and therefore our nervous system, right, and our emotions. So what I work with parents is, how do we parent the nervous system then? So how do we tap into that nervous system and support that first, support that, so then the mind can feel calm? So we work from the bottom up, and this is much more effective with kids. So just know that if your intuition, if your gut, it's telling you that people are telling me medication is the path, but I don't want to do that. There is another way. I promise you that. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is that the parent-child connection really is the key to a happy and confident child. So parents that come to me often have tried everything. They've gone to psychologists, psychiatrists, they've gone to OTs, they've gone to speeches, they've gone to guidance counselors, you name it, they've done it. And I think the trap that parents can fall into within society that's actually giving this message, by the way, so this is that nobody's at fault here if you believe this, but I think parents get into a trap that I need other people to understand my child. I need them to figure out what's wrong with my child, or I need my child to talk to them. I need, you know, I need all of this support. And it leaves the parent feeling disempowered because they don't understand their child. They don't find out what's going on for them. And the child doesn't feel understood by their parent. And if there is the one thing that's going to make all the difference for your child with any behaviors, any issues, any struggles, it's your relationship. It's your connection. It's your attachment. It's how you bond. It's the time you spend with them. They do not want to be understood by the psychologist. They do not. They couldn't care less about the psychologist understanding them. They want you as the parent to understand them. And that's not to put pressure on you. That's just the reality of human behavior 101. And we can't escape that one. I'm really sorry, we can't. So your relationship to your child is really the key here. And that's what I teach in all my programs, is that parents leave being the expert, not me, not the psychologist, that parents are the expert. They're the behavior specialist, not me. Because
they're in an environment. I mean, what you see someone for an hour a week compared to someone being there all the time. Yeah,
that's right.
And so it's so important to build that before the children are influenced from externally, from school and those environments, because things do change and there's a lot of other influences then coming in. That was just so informative. I've really enjoyed the conversation, Jessica, and learned so much. And I'm sure that the listeners, if they've got anything that they want to discuss, how do they get in touch with you?
Yeah. So a couple of ways, depending on how much stalking your listeners like to do. So you can go on all my social medias. So I'm all over it. There's Instagram, jessica.mcelveen, Facebook, Jessica McElveen. There's also the Happy Home Network Instagram page. So, yeah, Google my name. You'll find me. Otherwise, go to my website, jessicamcelveen.com.
And all of the connections will be in the course notes, in the podcast notes as well. So you'll be able to find Jessica. I think it's such an important subject. And, you know, normally we talk about issues that really pertain to women in business or in life. But parenting is such, you know, it's your most important job, and to be able to feel that you have a bit of a handle, I suppose, as a way to define it, is such an important aspect of doing that, or seeking people like Jessica that can help you create that happy home network. Yeah. Enjoy that. Thank you so much, Jessica.
Thank you.
Really loved it. Yeah, it's been great. Yeah. And that's another episode of the We Are Women podcast. I am Janine Bosby, your host. Remember, you can book a business strategy call or just a strategy call conversation by going to janinebosba.com. Please check me out on all of the socials. I'm not on TikTok, though, but on everything else. You will find me out there. Say hi and connect. And I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the We Are Women podcast. Bye-bye for now.
So, do you feel stuck in a rut in business? Visit speechperfect.com.au and download Janine's free ebook to avoid the 5 most common stumbling blocks women face in business. It's jam-packed full of tips to overcome the barriers that could be holding you back from the success that you dream your business will be. We would love you to leave a review of today's episode and share this podcast with other women in need of entrepreneurial inspiration. Subscribe to the next episode now and join the We Are Women community.